So first of all, are there questions before I get going? No. Okay, so I want to say a few last things about strong coupling theories. And recall that yesterday we spoke about Technicolor, and we have this Technicolor scale. It's kind of a, if you like, a scale up of QCD, and it corresponds, it ends up being roughly in standard Technicolor theories on the order of a few hundred GeV. And this gave a nice pattern of electric symmetry breaking, but we ran into some other related problems. We didn't have fermion masses, and when we went to generate fermion masses by going and taking Technicolor and embedding it in a larger ETC, extended Technicolor theory, we were able to generate some fermion masses, but we got new troubles. So new troubles in the form of higher dimensional operators that could lead to things like flavor violation or so on. By the time we fix those, we're no longer able to get the standard model fermion masses right. But we can play tricks, and there's this idea of walking Technicolor where you have strong normalization group effects that suppress the bad operators in extended Technicolor. So that's not so bad. But even if you sort out all that stuff and you don't worry about the Higgs, there's still a problem with lambda TC being of order a few hundred GeV. And that is that your theory is going to, your theory is very strong, your lambda TC. And you're going to have techni pions and possibly some techni baryons and all sorts of essentially Technicolor bound states. As you start probing the theory above lambda TC, you can start to see things like techni gluons and techni quarks. And if you take those things into account, it's hard to do this analytically, but you can make reasonable estimates. If you take these things into account, you also get corrections to weak vector boson couplings. So you get corrections in the form of, I'm just going to draw it as a blob for now. You get corrections to the self-energies of the W and the Z and the photon. And these corrections have the effect of modifying the couplings of the W and the Z and the photon to standard model fermions. And you can test for this thing. You can test for this thing by measuring weak interaction processes very, very, very carefully. And this kind of thing is called precision electroweak tests. Where you look for this kind of new stuff coupling to the W and the Z and the photon. And there is a tension between having a Technicolor scale of a few hundred GeV and these precision electroweak tests. Now, it's hard to make concrete predictions because these theories are strongly coupled. And you're looking at them right at relatively high energies where you don't have much theoretical control. But you can make educated guesses. And educated guesses suggest that typically, unless you have some kind of funny cancellation that you wouldn't necessarily expect, lambda of TC on the order of a few hundred GeV is inconsistent with these precision electroweak tests. Now, to be able to not worry, you'd want lambda TC to be more like a few TeV, or possibly even higher. But once you push lambda TC to be much larger than a few hundred GeV, your W and Z masses also go up, and it no longer works anymore. So even beyond all these other problems of Technicolor, and the fact that you don't have a Higgs, and you see a Higgs, there is an extension of Technicolor theories, or something that can be related to Technicolor theories, that is a bit different in terms of its electric symmetry breaking than regular Technicolor. And the idea there is, goes by the name of composite, or sometimes little Higgs. And I'll come back and talk more about the composite story a bit later on. But the general idea here is that instead of breaking electroweak symmetry with a Technicolor group, instead you have some new strong coupling. So I'm not going to call it technicolor. I'll call it, let's say lambda star. A lambda star is ideally on the order of, let's say, a few TeV or above. So I'll do a greater squiggle. And the idea here is this strong dynamics generates a bound state with the same quantum numbers as a standard model Higgs. So here, from the strong coupling, you get a quote-unquote Higgs field, capital H. I'll put it in brackets, to suggest that the idea is that this is some composite scalar excitation. So just like we saw in our theory of pions coming out of QCD or Technicolor, we got the low energy degrees of freedom very different from the high energy degrees of freedom. So in QCD, you have quarks and gluons. And at low energies, you have these scalar pions. The idea in these composite and little Higgs type theories is that you have some relatively large strong coupling scale. And below that, the strong coupling dynamics gives you some composite scalar state that you can ident- that has the quantum numbers of a Higgs. And then this Higgs hangs around for a bit. And then at some lower scale, the Higgs gets an expectation value. So two things have to go right for this to work. First of all, you need to generate this composite scalar Higgs field. And second of all, you need to justify why its mass is less than this lambda star scale of a few TeV. So the problem is a little bit better than before. But in this picture, we're pushing up our strong coupling scale to a few TeV. And this is essentially what you want to do for positional electroweak. But we're still left with this so-called little hierarchy problem, where we want to justify why this composite scalar Higgs is parametrically lighter than the strong coupling scale here. So this is where these composite and little Higgs theories come in. And the idea behind them is that this Higgs field is associated with an approximate Nembe-Goldstone boson mode. So there's some sort of global symmetry such that if the global symmetry were exact, the Higgs would be massless. And you put in an explicit breaking. So now the symmetry is no longer an exact symmetry, but it's still a good approximate symmetry. And that lets you get a parametrically lighter composite Higgs state relative to this cutoff scale. So just a word about the terminology. Typically, in composite Higgs theories, people often try to write down the strongly coupled theory and then get the Higgs out of it. In little Higgs theory, the strong coupling part is kind of thrown away. And what I mean by that is people just start by assuming some input scale, lambda star, and they assume some symmetry structure. And they just find the Goldstone modes associated with that symmetry structure and then work down. So in little Higgs theories, you don't even bother trying to construct a strongly coupled theory that gives rise to the dynamics you want. You just put in you just assume you have a certain symmetry structure and a certain cutoff, and you just work in the effective theory down here. So the little part of little Higgs is that you're only addressing this part of the hierarchy problem. You're not addressing the full hierarchy problem from here all the way up to the Planck scale. You're assuming that something comes in at this scale and it fixes everything up. Whereas typically the composite Higgs theories are a little bit more ambitious and embed something like a little Higgs mechanism within a full theory all the way up to let's say the Planck scale. So I'm going to come back to, there's a lot of stuff one could do for little Higgs. The composite Higgs story turns out to have the nicest description, the most popular description in terms of extra dimensional theories. So right now I'm going to change topics. I'm going to jump to extra dimensions. And then after spending a bit of time on extra dimensions, if I have time, I'll come back to this idea of a composite Higgs and trying to relate it through the extra dimensional story to a strongly coupled theory. Change my notes. Okay, so my notes on strong coupling are up in relatively decent shape. I only have handwritten notes from extra dimensional stuff, but I'll try to tech them up and get them posted either later this week or early next week. But in any case, the next picture, change of pace, is extra dimensions, XD for short. And the place where extra dimensions come in, a large motivator is the hierarchy problem. So with supersymmetry, we address the hierarchy problem by arranging for a cancellation based on a symmetry or an approximate symmetry. In strongly coupled theories, we got rid of the fundamental Higgs altogether, and that got rid of the hierarchy problem for us. In extra dimensions, the idea is going to be instead of trying to fix things in a sense such that you can go all the way up to a very high energy, instead what we're going to do is take the very high energy Planck scale and bring it down in a sense. So what I mean by this is we're going to try to fix a hierarchy by saying that the fundamental scale of quantum gravity, which we think is M Planck, the idea of extra dimensions is you try to take this fundamental scale of quantum gravity, M star, and you try to arrange for it to be much less than M Planck. And ideally, you want it to be on the order of, let's say, TeV or so. And the way this is usually achieved is through dilution. So I'll give you a few examples of dilution in a second. And for this dilution, the extra dimensions help. And there are roughly two different pictures. So the first picture for dilution is dilute. Actually, I should say dilute. And the second approach is so right now, this is going to sound cryptic. I'm either diluting M star through a volume of an extra dimension or through localization in an extra dimension. The volume idea is that suppose we're confined to a subset of a larger space with extra dimensions. And gravity, being gravity, has to go everywhere. So gravity goes in the extra dimension. If we're stuck in a subset of the extra dimension, let's say a lower dimensional part of the full extra dimensions, what we see as gravity, the gravitational force in some sense can leak out into the extra dimension. And the effective force will end up, in that case, being diluted by the volume of the extra dimension. In the second case, suppose we live in one part of a higher dimensional space. And suppose gravity is pushed, in a sense, to another part of the extra dimensional space. In that case, even though the fundamental scale of gravity might be M star, what we see as gravity will appear to be much weaker. So I'll come back to this. The first thing I want to do is just do a quick recap. You may have seen this, you may not have, and you'll see more of it in the tutorial today. But I wanted to give an example of what a field theory looks like in five dimensions. So I'm going to write d is equal to 4 plus n. So n is a number of extra dimensions. D is a total number of space-time dimensions. And we're always going to assume that the extra dimensions are space-like, in the sense that we're not adding time dimensions, we're only adding space dimensions. Adding time dimensions gets confusing and complicated because of causality and such. So we're just going to add space-like dimensions. I'm not saying that it's not possible to do time-like dimensions, but I don't know too many examples. Okay, and I can write a flat metric in the full extra dimension space, And the flat metric would just be the usual metric. So 0, 1, 2, 3. So this is DAG. And then for the flat metric, it's also minus 1 for all the n's. And in general, I'm going to write the M indices, so the uppercase indices being the full extra dimensional index. I'll write Greek indices as just 0, 1, 2, 3, the usual four space. And then for the extra dimensional indices, I'll typically use a lowercase Roman letter. OK, so for extra dimensions, the first thing I want to talk about is, let's say I take my space to be just regular old Minkowski space plus the extra dimension to be a circle. So in other words, let's push this up. Let's say I take n equals to 1. And let me assume that my x4, my extra dimension, I'll call it w. And I'll assume that it lives in 0, 2 pi r for some radius r. So in other words, if you like, this is my extra dimension going around like this, from 0 to 2 pi r, and I think of r as a radius of this extra dimension. So in this case, the action, so let me do the simplest case, just a field theory of a free scalar. For a free scalar, my action is going to be d4x, and integral 0 to 2 pi r dw of 1 half a to mn, del m phi, del n phi, minus 1 half m squared, phi squared. So everything just takes the same structure that you're familiar with, but now I've just added an extra dimension, and I've assumed that it's periodic on a circle. And again, for the action, I just integrate over all the space dimensions, whatever their geometry, and the Lagrangian looks just like I would normally have, except that now I have this a to mn piece. And this a to mn, if I expand it out, is going to be, assuming flat space, I'm going to have the usual a to mu nu, del mu phi, del nu phi. But the extra piece is going to be a minus del 5 phi. So just to warn you, a lot of times when you only have one extra dimension, instead of going 0, 1, 2, 3 and calling the next one 4, people call it 5, because you talk about the fifth dimension. On the other hand, if you have multiple extra dimensions, usually you start at 4 and just go to n, because otherwise the skipping gets complicated. OK, in any case, the question is how to deal with this, how to quantize it. And the way to quantize it is fairly straightforward. What we do is we use the fact that the dependence of phi on this coordinate is periodic. So in other words, this changes. So my phi is going to depend on x and w being the extra dimension. And because I should come back around to the same spot after 2 pi, my x should be periodic, like so. And if you recall from some math course or other, any periodic function can be expanded in terms of either a set of sines or cosines, or equivalently a set of exponentials. And that means that I can do an expansion of this sort. I can write my phi of x of w as a sum over n equals minus infinity to plus infinity. Let me just get the normalization right. 1 over root 2 pi r e to the I So what I'm doing is just, a discrete Fourier transform. So I'm taking this function of x in the extra dimension. And because it's periodic, I can expand any function of this form, at least for the W dependence, in terms of a set of basis functions that are periodic, plus a set of coefficients. And now this set of coefficients has to be x dependent to match up with the x dependence of this. The other thing is that this phi, we're assuming it's a real scalar field. And that means that there are some non-trivial initial relations between phi n. So because phi is equal to phi dagger, this implies that phi n dagger is equal to phi minus n. And that's easy to see by just matching up these and using the fact that these are independent basis functions. So what I can do is take this form, take this expansion, this is completely general, and plug it in here. And when I plug it in here, I have these coefficient functions and these exponentials. We sometimes call these exponentials the wave functions in the extra dimension. I take this, I plug this in, and what I get, using the orthogonality of these exponentials, and you'll get a chance to do this in the homework, sorry, in the tutorial today, is I just get an integral d4x times 1 half in this del phi 0 squared minus 1 half m squared phi 0 squared plus a sum on n equals 1 to infinity So all I've done to get this is I've taken this form, I plug in this expansion. As far as this expansion goes, recall that these so-called wave functions or these basis functions are an orthonormal set on the space. And after I plug these in principle, I'm going to have a sum on this phi and a sum on that phi. But with two sums on phi and I do the integral over w, I use the orthogonality. And the orthogonality, well, the orthogonality is trivial for the so-called zero mode. But the orthogonality for all the higher modes selects out the combination where I have minus n and plus n. And here I've used the fact that the minus n corresponds to n dagger. So the interpretation of this is that this is a so-called zero mode scalar. And its mass is just this initial mass, m squared. And these guys, I have an infinite tower of them. These guys are known as Kaluza-Klein modes, or KK modes. And the mass of the nth KK mode is just m squared plus n squared over r squared. And this is what happens generically when you take r spacetime and add onto it an extra compact space. So here I've added the most simple extra compact space, just a nice circle. And what I see is that my theory of a single real five-dimensional field can be decomposed into an infinite tower of four-dimensional fields. And this infinite tower of four-dimensional fields consists of the zero mode plus these KK modes And the KK modes, well, there's an infinite tower of them, for one thing. And even though I started with a real scalar, these are now complex scalars. And the fact that you have complex scalars corresponds to the fact that if you expand a set of periodic functions, I could have also expanded in terms of sines and cosines. And I could have done an equivalent thing. And in terms of sines and cosines, if you like, for each n, I have 2 degrees of freedom. And these 2 degrees of freedom here I've just organized into a complex scalar. So, yes?
So if you have a reduction in a circle, I also get another scalar gravitational fluctuations, right?
So far I haven't put in gravity at all. So I'm just fixing the background space time. I'm not worrying about the fluctuations. We'll come back to that. Okay. In any case, I wanted to cover this so that you'll get more practice at doing this in the tutorial today. But I wanted to cover this because I'm now going to focus on the first kind of dilution mechanism that will use this dilution but apply to the graviton in some set of extra dimensions. But the general thing that happens when you have extra space-time dimensions, or extra spatial dimensions, I should say, on a compact space, is that you can do a similar orthonormal expansion of the extra-dimensional spaces, and in terms of those exponential functions, I get a set of KK modes. And in general, I'm going to get one of these KK indices for each extra dimension I have. So for example, a slightly more complicated thing, if you want to practice, is like I could have put 2 extra dimensions that are 2 circles. In this case, I would have, let's say, W1, W2. I'd have an exponential expansion on W1 and an exponential expansion on W2. And now I'd have 2 sets of indices, N1 and N2. And the masses would look like N1 squared plus N2 squared. Okay. In any case, this is the KK mode expansion story. The next thing I want to get to specifically is the idea of dilution. So let me get back to my notes. I have to jump ahead. OK, so the first dilution mechanism relies on volume. And it's known as large extra dimensions, or LED. OK, so the idea behind large extra dimensions is that, again, suppose we live in d equals 4 plus n. And suppose gravity is able to propagate in more dimensions than we are. So the idea there is if you write down gravity, let's say in the Newtonian approximation, but in multiple dimensions, the relation for your the relation star 2 plus n, the relation for your gravitational potential relative to the energy density looks something like this, where I have n extra dimensions, and m star is fundamental gravity scale. So in the regular 4 dimensions, n would be 0. I'd have m star, 1 over m star here. And that would correspond to your usual 1 over m Planck squared. So n equals 0, I have m star coinciding with m Planck. Now, the force law that you get from this for a pair of test masses ends up being, up to order 1 constants, ends up being 1 over m star to the 2 plus n, m1, m2, over r to the 2 plus n. And the reason I get the 2 plus n is I could apply Gauss's law to this in the same way I would in 3 spatial dimensions. But now with more dimensions, I have essentially more directions for the flux to spread out. And because I have more ways for the flux to spread out, I get a 2 plus n instead of 2. So, and again, this obviously reduces to our usual expression. OK, so this is a generic case for gravity in lots of extra dimensions. But now suppose we take our n extra dimensions and assume that they're compact. So and let's say we assume they're compactified on a circle, just like we had over here. So in this case, if we look on scales that are much, much larger than the radius r, we're not going to see the extra dimensions. So if we step back and look over like gravity over large distances, instead of seeing this relation, in a sense, if gravity has to go a long way relative to the extra dimension, it gets channeled. Instead of diluting as 1 over r to the 2n, it gets diluted only as 1 over r squared, provided we look over distances much larger than the radius of the extra dimensions. So specifically, what you get is times m1, m2. So at short distances, if you measure the strength of gravity at short distances, you see the 1 over r to the 2 plus n. But at long distances, it turns out that you get m1, m2 over r squared. And instead of having the n here, what you get is 2 pi r to the n. Just because you only see the gravitational flux lines that they travel a long distance, and if you like, they're channeled through the tube, so they only fall up as 1 over r squared. So the upshot of this is that if I compare this to my usual gravitational expression of 1 over r squared, this matches up the usual expression provided m Planck squared is equal to m star to the n plus 2 times 2 pi r to the n, which I can write as m star n2 times the volume, the total volume of all the extra dimensions. So here each extra dimension has, if you like, volume 2 pi r, and the total volume is just a product. So I'm just writing this expression, this thing, as a volume. And this is the main idea of large extra dimensions, that if your extra dimensions are small enough, but not too small, the Planck scale you get can be very different from m star, provided the radius is somewhat large, parametrically. And if we want to have m star, let's say order TeV, this implies that my 2 pi r scale is roughly, well, it turns out to be 10 to the 32 over n times 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. If you just plug in the numbers and crank away. And that means that for n equals 1, this turns out to be roughly 10 to the 15 centimeters. It's about 1 millimeter for n equals 2. And it's about 1 micrometer for n equals 3, and on and on and on. So let's bring this up. So the story we have with this is, okay, this is ruled out. So this distance is larger than the distance from us to the sun. So if the extra dimensions were that big, we wouldn't be seeing the 1 over r squared law astronomically. So this is no good. This 1 millimeter scale, though, is kind of interesting. When this idea of gravity dilution as a way to address the hierarchy problem was first suggested, it turns out that the force of gravity, the 1 over r squared law for gravity, had not been tested down to distances of order of a millimeter. So gravity being very weak is very hard to test. And it just it turns out that nobody had ever been able to test the 1/r² law for objects, let's say, separated by 1 millimeter. I mean, and you can kind of imagine why. It's just there's a lot of stuff going on that's not gravity that's hard to cancel out. But so initially, n equals 2 looked good. But when this was suggested, it prompted a lot of experimental work. There's a lot of very nice experimental tests of gravity over shorter distances, and it turns out that this is now ruled out. This, it turns out, is still okay. So the current limit on this 2πr scale is it has to be less than roughly 37 microns, if I have it right. So it's still a bit less than 1 millimeter, but still larger than 1 micrometer. So this idea for diluting gravity is, if you like, taking by diluting gravity with extra dimensions, we're able to bring down the fundamental Planck scale near to the weak scale. And at this point, we no longer have a hierarchy problem for the weak scale, because the weak scale is just popping out close to the fundamental scale. It's just that what we think is gravity is actually much stronger than what gravity looks like because of this so-called volume dilution. Now, lots of issues come up here. First of all, these distances that you need to get a TeV scale M star are very large compared to a lot of fundamental scales. So I can convert the radius of the extra dimension into an effective mass scale in my natural units. And recall that my KK modes, or if I try to put fields in this extra dimensional space, I'll get KK modes on top of our standard model fields. So typically, we'll identify standard model fields with zero modes. And the KK modes will be excitations on top of that if you try to put the standard model into an extra dimensional space. And in this case, the standard model KK modes would end up being very light. And the reason for this is that if I fix M star to be about a TeV, and I take the M Planck to be, well, the measured value, it turns out that the 2 pi r scale is about 10 to the minus 13 GeV for n equals 2, 10 to the minus 8 GeV for n equals 3, and something like 10 to the minus 2 GeV for n equals 6, and on and on and on. So unless I have a huge number of extra dimensions, the masses of the KK modes are going to be the KK mode splitting relative to the zero mode is going to be very small. And for example, even if we went to six extra dimensions, six extra dimensions has a good piece, is nicely motivated from string theory. So a lot of string theory constructions are based on a total of 10 dimensions. So you have six or possibly seven extra dimensions. But even in those cases, the n equals 6 and n equals 7, the splitting of the KK modes relative to the zero mode is very small compared to what we can measure. And this is ruled out. So this means that at least if you try to put the standard model in the extra dimension, we're out of luck. And for a long time, this is why people didn't try to use this dilution mechanism to address the hierarchy problem. They just figured, OK, but in this extra dimension, the standard model is going to have all these KK modes, and that's ruled out. But I guess about 15 years ago now, a lot of progress was made in string theory. And one thing that came out of string theory is it was discovered that you can have, if you like, solutions in string theory where you have surfaces within a higher dimensional space upon which you confine some of your fields. So in other words, it was discovered that you have these objects called brains. A brain is, if you like, a subsurface within the larger extra dimension, such that some fields in the theory, when you reduce it to an effective field theory, some fields in the theory are confined to these brains. So instead of having all your fields travel in all the dimensions, it was discovered that you can have some of the fields travel in only a subset of the dimensions, or in some regions of the extra dimensional space. So motivated by that, the large extra dimensions case is the picture of standard model and these large so this, if you like, is the large extra dimensions model. We confine the standard model to 3 plus 1 dimensions. So the standard model doesn't have any KK modes of its own. But gravity, because being gravity, and it tells you what space-time is doing, has to travel everywhere. And in this case, having gravity in extra dimension means that it will get diluted. And our fundamental Planck scale can be close to the weak scale, even though what we see as gravity is much in four dimensions is much smaller. OK, so specifically, let's look at, OK, so there are actually lots of different specific realizations where you choose different geometries for the extra dimensions. Let's just look at the simplest case of we assume extra dimension So let's assume that our extra dimensions are all circles. We might have multiple circles, but they're all circles. If you like, this corresponds to an n-torus. Our standard model is confined to four dimensions, and specifically the four-dimensional subspace of the full higher dimensional space such that all these w's are equal to zero. So this is just a cartoon, but it's like saying that our standard model and the extra dimensional space lives here, and then all the extra dimensions are circles on top of that. Okay. So let me just figure out where I want to start. So what we have to do at this point is, okay, well, we more or less know how to deal with the standard model. We're going to assume for the time being that the full geometry is just fixed. So we're not going to look at fluctuations in the size of the extra dimension. But what we do have to do is take gravity and write down at least an effective theory of gravity that works in all these extra dimensions. And the part of that that we'll have to deal with at the end of the day is what will amount to a KK expansion of the graviton field. OK, so I'm going to write GMN is equal to be the full metric and it turns out that the gravity action in this case is equal to get this right 1/2 m star to the m plus 2 integral d4x integral dnw minus root g to the d. And this is it. So this is the Ricci scalar. You compute out of the full d-dimensional metric. This is its square root of the determinant. This is the fundamental Planck scale. And then I integrate over all the space-time. Question?
Like a general question. In general, KK theory, is there a mechanism to get rid of the extra modes? The gravity would be like, it seems like that would have bad implications cosmology.
We'll come back to the cosmology story for the graviton. Typically, in theories where you put the standard model into the extra dimension, the size of the extra dimension has to be at least about an inverse TeV. So in that case, the splitting between your KK modes and the standard model KK modes are larger than about a TeV. And yes, so this says they also go up infinitely high. But it turns out that when you put in interactions, for any typical interaction that looks renormalizable in four dimensions, when you write down the same thing in five dimensions, it ends up being non-renormalizable. So these extra dimensional theories always have to be interpreted as effective theories with a cutoff on the that ends up, if you look at it carefully, on the order of 4 pi r. So the extra dimensional theories will always be effective field theories. Now, as far as this stuff goes, we'll end up with, this is for putting the standard model in. It'll be a bit different for gravity. But in any case, you never actually keep an infinite number of KK modes because your effective theory is breaking down anyhow. OK, so going back to gravity, this is just a generalization of the four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action to d dimensions. No problem. And just like we did before, we can find our graviton mode by expanding around flat space. And here I'm defining this as a fluctuation with some coefficient. This coefficient is chosen such that if I write down the field theory for this field, plugging into here, expanding around the flat metric, this real scalar ends up coming out with a canonical normalization. So this is just a choice for how I normalize my field. And if you check, you end up getting the dimensions working out properly. So we also have, so this is the gravity side. We also have the standard model. So this is the gravity side. For the standard model, lives on the subspace with all the W set to 0. So we're going to define G mu nu to be the first components of the full metric of x at W equals to 0. So this is called the induced metric on the space where the standard model lives. And the action for the standard model turns out to be, again, just the usual minimal coupling, d4x minus root g, where this g is that g, times the standard model Lagrangian built out of g mu nu, and so on and so forth. And also in the usual way, I can define my energy momentum tensor this way. And if I take this, if I take this expression, expand it out, use this fact, this implies that my standard model action can be written as an expansion of these fluctuations as the flat space piece, so the background piece with the induced metric, plus the leading term that couples, it's going to couple the graviton field to the standard model, turns out to be a T mu nu H mu nu times 1 over M star, the 1 plus N over 2. And then you can have higher order terms going to higher in the expansion. But the upshot of this is the leading coupling of the standard model of this part of the graviton on the space where the standard model lives, this sort of point on the circle, ends up being this. And this tells me how the standard model couples to gravity. And this coupling is exactly the same form that you get in four-dimensional GR. And it's a standard story of the graviton fluctuation coupling to the energy momentum tensor. OK, so let me go over here. I'm running out of blackboards, but well. OK, so at this point, the other thing we have to do is take our gravity action and try to figure out the KK mode structure of the graviton. So just like we saw for the complex scalar, OK, you guys, I just covered it up. But just like for the complex scalar, because our graviton field is traveling in multiple space-time dimensions, it's going to have KK modes. So we want to figure out what those KK modes are. The zero mode, we're going to identify with the usual graviton of general relativity. It had better be massless, or we're going to mess up general relativity. But we're definitely going to have massive graviton KK mode excitations. And these might have various transformations under the four-dimensional Lorentz group. And these objects, when I expand them out, when I take my h mu nu and I expand it in terms of KK modes, this will tell me, first of all, how my regular graviton couples to the standard model. But it will also tell me how my KK mode gravitons couple to the standard model. And once I have that coupling, I can look into ways to try to discover those KK gravitons. So the story here is, for n extra dimensions, instead of, OK, I'm going to cheat on notation a bit. Here I have n extra dimensions, and here n was indexing the KK modes. These are different n's. I probably should have used a different variable, but my apologies. Here for my n extra dimensions, OK, actually, just to avoid confusion, let's say I call it n for now instead of little n. If I have n extra dimensions, I can expand my hmn of x and w as I get one KK mode expansion I'll just write it this way. So what I mean by n here is n is a vector with entries n1, n2, and n. And n dot w is just n1, w1, plus n, where my w1 to n parameterized at extra dimensions. So again, I have x mu, and then I have wa, where a is equal to 1, 2. I may have changed in indexing midstream, but I'll help you get the idea of what I'm doing. I have n, big N periodic coordinates. So for each of those periodic coordinates, I have an exponential. I expand in all of those. These are all orthogonal relative to each other. And then I have a set of KK modes. They're labeled by this set of n n's. I have too many n's, but I'm running out of variables. So this is my KK mode expansion. And if I take this and I plug back in over there, this means that my standard model part, the Lagrangian, is going to be just the usual part, the background piece, plus my coupling. And my coupling, d4x, is going to give me, after I sum over all the modes and use orthogonality and integrate over the extra dimensions, what I get is a 1 over m star 1 plus n over 2 times 1 over 2 pi r to the n over 2 times a sum on all of these n's of h mu nu of n t mu nu standard model. So what I've done here is almost identical to what I did there. I plugged in the expansion for the KK modes. And then I used the orthogonality of these basis functions to do all of the W integrals. And I'm left with this integral over 4 space. So the usual action, here I have my 1 over m star that comes from before. This is the extra piece that's left over from the from essentially the volumes. And then I have this direct coupling. And this piece, if I compare with the previous expression, just corresponds to my 1 over m Planck. So for the zero mode is going to couple to the standard model of energy momentum tensor with a 1 over m Planck coupling. And this is exactly what I have in the four-dimensional standard model coupled to gravity minimally. But now I also see I have essentially the same coupling of all my KK modes. So this, if you like, is completely equivalent to this argument about forces bleeding out into extra dimensions. Here, what I'm seeing is that the effective coupling of the zero KK mode, which is the only one relevant at very large distances, couples as 1 over m Planck. But I also have these higher KK modes that also couple with 1 over m Planck strength. OK. So now there's one more aspect to this. We have these KK modes. In this case, the mu nu components. But our full KK field lives in d dimensions. And I also have the extra components of hmn with m and n larger than mu. So that means that on top of the mu nu components of this field, I'm going to have other components of the field on top of that. And we have to deal with those as well. So what we can do is take our KK mode, possibly also the zero mode, and write as hmn of x. And I can split my m and n by mu's and nu's and a's and so on. So what I mean by that is I'm going to have an h mu nu of n that depends on x. But I can also have an h mu a of n, depending on x. Or I could have an h a b of n. So here, a and b run from 1 to n over the extra dimensions. And this thing is a two-component symmetric tensor. So recall that because it's a graviton, hmn is equal to plus hnm. It's a symmetric tensor. These things are going to be two-component symmetric tensors. So that's fine. These things I'm going to write as v mu a of n. And I'm going to write these guys as s a b of n. So in terms of the four-dimensional Lorentz group, these are two-component symmetric tensors. These are vectors under the transformation law, under the four-dimensional Lorentz subgroup. And these are scalars. So I'm calling it vector scalar. And my initial hmn has, well, my initial hmn has d times d plus 1 over 2 components because it's a symmetric tensor. But I also have a set of coordinates, coordinate invariance transformation I can use to remove some of those degrees of freedom. And it turns out that there are 2D constraints. So as far as this hmn goes, if I count degrees of freedom, I have d d plus 1 over 2 minus 2d. So the dd plus 1 over 2 just comes about because I have d entries here, and they're symmetric. But I have 2d constraints I can impose through through general coordinate invariance. So this is equal to d minus 3 over 2. And now I can apply this to both the zero modes and the KK modes here. And the zero modes and KK modes will look a little bit different in terms of degrees of freedom. So I'll do the zero mode here. So here I've got my h mu nu of n, my v mu a of n, my s a b of n. So for the zero mode, this is a massless two-component object, so it still has 2 degrees of freedom. Here, these are massless vectors, so each has 2 of them, but I have a. So a goes from 1 to n, so I have 2 times n. And here I have these a, b indices, but these a, b indices are symmetric, recall, and they're just scalars, so I just have 1 times n plus 1 over 2. And if I sum over all the degrees of freedom at this level, what I get is 1 half n squared plus 5n plus 4, which you can show is equal to d minus 3 over 2, where d is equal to 4 plus n. So the degree of freedom counting matches up for the zero modes. And then for the KK modes, let's say at a given level n, not equal to the zero vector, what I have is my graviton is now a massive graviton. And a massive graviton has generally spin 2. So spin 2 has 5 components. These guys also get KK mode masses. So they're massive vectors. And those massive vectors have they have three components each. And normally I would have n of them. But it turns out that one combination can be removed by a remnant of general coordinate invariance. So for these vectors, it turns out that I have 3n minus 1. And then for these SABs, I also have another remnant of general coordinate invariance. And it gives me n plus 1 over 2 minus n constraints. So the constraint here just turns out to be NA times V mu NA is equal to 0. And the constraint here is that, and the constraint here is NA dot, no vector here, SAB is equal to 0. But in any case, if I count up my degrees of freedom, in this case, I get back, again, the same number here. So what's happening is that for my vectors, some fraction of the vectors and some fraction of the scalars are going to make the massive graviton at each KK level. And some fraction of the scalars are going to make up the rest of the mass. So at each KK level, I still have the right number of degrees of freedom, but they're redistributed in different ways. So in the zero mode case, I just have the scalars, vectors, and massless spin 2 states. At each KK mode, though, I have a rearrangement such that I automatically get, when I take into account all the constraints, massless spin 2 particle, massless spin 1 particle, and massless scalars. But the counting ends up being a bit different because some of the scalars are eaten by the vectors, and some of the vectors are eaten by the spin 2 state. So I should wrap it up there. I've gone a bit over. But we'll finish off large extra dimensions and then talk about warped extra dimensions tomorrow.